Well, thank you very much. Good morning, everybody. I would like to thank you, Will, and Jennifer, Freedom House, your colleague Chris Walker in particular, who's played a very important role in this conference and the study. Let me thank Libby Liu and her team at Radio Free Asia, and my colleagues, Diane Zeleny and her team, who played a central role from our side in doing this. And to you, Chairman Hastings, that was passionate, eloquent, and of course, from our perspective, very useful. Thank you for that. I can't resist telling you that, as you know, with your support, we, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, has just completed a move into a brand new, safe, secure facility in Prague. 6 weeks ago, when we were mostly complete with that move, we decided to invite your friend, Václav Havel, to come in not for a big ceremony with all bells and whistles and something to drink and all that sort of thing. We invited him in to chair the first editorial meeting in the building. And it was low-key. It was for tradition, continuity, for the future, for our employees. And I think, Chairman Hastings, you would have been happy and proud to see Václav Havel at the chair of the first editorial meeting in this new building with members around the table from Afghanistan, Iraq, Iran, Russia, Belarus, you mentioned, Central Asia, and so forth. So I wanted to mention that to you, and I hope you'll be with us soon there, too. But you will have to chair an editorial meeting if you come. The panel, which we have here today, is truly distinguished. It's my pleasure to introduce them, invite them to take the floor. Let me first introduce Peter Beinart, sitting to my right. He is a fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is a former editor and editor-at-large of The New Republic. He is also author of the book The Good Fight. And if I may just read from the cover to you, "Once upon a time, liberals knew what they believed. They believed America must lead the world by persuasion, not command. That liberal spirit won America's trust at the dawn of the Cold War. Now, after the failed presidency of George W. Bush, America needs it back." We'll hear from Peter Beinart in just one moment. Let me introduce the other two panelists. To Peter's right, Bob Kagan, scholar at the Carnegie Endowment, historian, essayist, director of a new think tank called Foreign Policy Initiative. His most recent book, The Return of History and the End of Dreams. I hold that up so you can see that as well. Bob Kagan, welcome to you. And then last but not least, to Bob's right, James Traub, who writes for the New York Times Magazine, works for and with the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect, and is also a prolific writer and author of the recent book, The Freedom Agenda, Why America Must Spread Democracy, parentheses, Just Not the Way George Bush Did, end of parentheses. Bob Kagan, you're going to be left to defend George W. Bush, but I'm not sure you're going to want to do that. With that, I think the proposition is clear from the study and what Will gave as introduction today and Chairman Hastings. The proposition is simply put that authoritarians are getting better. They are updating methods. In some ways, they're becoming more sophisticated. In some instances, they are spending lavishly. And the question posed is what to do about it. Peter, would you begin?
Sure. Thanks very much. Just make a couple points. The first comes...
Is this on? From Obama's speech this morning, which I thought was the thing that struck me the most about the speech in Cairo was his emphasis on moral reciprocity. I think what will get the most attention probably is the kind of the reciprocity that he talked about between Israel and the Palestinians. But I think at least as important, maybe more important, was the way in which he talked about moral reciprocity between the United States in our actions and nations, mostly non-democratic nations in the Middle East. He was very tough, I thought, fairly tough on the democracy stuff, but he also talked about America's responsibility to close Guantanamo Bay. And he talked about American history, the history of the Cold War, in a very different way than I think the Bush and Cheney talked about American history, as this kind of glorious triumph in which America was always promoting democracy on the side of the angels. He talked about the overthrow of the Mossadegh government in Iran. He talked about... He did not talk about... about democracy as if America were on the far side of a river, having crossed the river, and therefore basically don't have to be involved in any moral struggle ourselves. I think he talked about it in a way which I think is much more compelling, about America, about there needing to be a sense of movement and struggle, democratic movement and struggle, human rights movement and struggle inside the United States, that we are not a finished product. And although he gets a lot of, you know, he gets attacked a lot for these apologies, I think what he's trying to convey is the idea that we do not simply make demands on others, but we see ourselves as involved in a reciprocal series of obligations as well. And that was very clear in his talk about nuclear weapons, which is a really big break from the past administration. Also talking about America's obligation to ultimately move towards reducing its nuclear arsenal. This is important not only because, and it's a cliche, but I think it's true, because our strongest weapon in promoting democracy is the power of America's own example. I think the Cold War bears that out. I think the strength of the American example is ultimately the single best tool we have against authoritarianism. But also for more practical reasons, we have to show, in some ways, in the same way that democracies had to show in the 1930s, that we, in fact, can provide economic prosperity and economic justice better than authoritarian countries. In that way, China is a much more formidable foe than the Soviet Union was, certainly by say, the 1960s or 1970s. And I think we have to rise to that challenge. It is not enough for America simply and our allies to be democracies. We have to show, as we did during the Cold War, that democracies could produce prosperity and fairness, equally distributed prosperity, in a way that authoritarian countries can't. I think that's part of our challenge. And the other reason that I think the America's image around the world is so important is, in a practical matter, it's simply much harder to push countries towards free elections if the populations hate our guts, and the likelihood of those free elections is going to be governments that are much more hostile to us than the present authoritarian ones. That puts our interests and our ideals in direct contradiction. The better America's image is in a place like Pakistan or in parts of the Middle East, the less pointed that contradiction will be between our interests and our values. I think one of the things that we sometimes don't focus on enough is that democratic movements are nationalist movements. Democracies ride upon nationalist movements. And in Eastern Europe, the nationalism was directed against the Soviet Union. But the bald reality is that in much of the world today, and certainly in the Middle East, the nationalism is directed against us and Israel in particular. And in that kind of circumstance, it seems to me, it makes democracy promotion much more difficult, whatever we can do, it seems to me, to not put ourselves in the bullseye of nationalist hostility, the easier it will be for us to promote democracy. And ultimately, I think the more we can do that, the more we will get to the place where I think we ultimately have to be, which is that the United States forthrightly, even aggressively, supports democratic elections in which Islamist parties take part. And in which, as long as they abide by the rules of the game, the rules of a free election, we do not take a position on who we want to win. I think that enormous damage has been done by the U.S. Response to the Hamas victory in Gaza. It is very, very understandable why the United States doesn't like Hamas. I have a good friend of mine from college was blown up in a bomb in Jerusalem by Hamas. I have no love lost for Hamas. But it was clearly going to be a setback in various ways to U.S. interests for Hamas to win that election. Still, I think we made a tragic mistake in retrospect by essentially saying to the Muslim world, if groups that we don't like win the election, then we're no longer in favor of democracy. Should we push Hamas to try to agree to past agreements? Absolutely. To recognize the state of Israel? Absolutely. But when Israel has elections and produces governments that don't abide by past agreements, that don't, in fact, recognize a two-state solution, we don't therefore say that we don't think it was good that Israel had a free election. We understand that there are political tides that we have to work with. The last point I would make is that I think most of the time. Obviously, circumstances differ. But I think we have sometimes gotten into a habit of talking in which we suggest that that coercion is the best or even the only method towards promoting democracy. And so that somehow, if Barack Obama is engaging aggressively with Cuba or with Iran, he is seen to have abandoned the democracy agenda. I think that's not right. There are different cases, and sometimes coercion might work better. But in general, I think, actually, engagement tends to be more productive than coercion in moving countries along the path towards democracy. And in this regard, I think we still in popular discourse have a very misguided understanding about the way the Cold War ended, and in particular about Ronald Reagan's role in ending the Cold War. I very strongly believe, and I think the historical evidence is very strongly on this side, that it was not Ronald Reagan's early efforts at coercion that helped to produce the process of dramatic change in the Soviet Union. It was the very, very intense process of diplomatic and arms control engagement with the Soviet Union, which, interestingly, Reagan started to get serious about even before Gorbachev took power, but which allowed Gorbachev to be able to say to his hardliners, we don't need this Eastern European security belt anymore because we don't think the United States is going to be a military threat to us. I really believe that if Ronald Reagan in 1987 had still acted like Ronald Reagan in 1981 or 1982, which was what many, many conservative pundits wanted him to do, that in fact it would have been much more difficult for Gorbachev to make those changes. So we have an image, it seems to me, from the end of the Cold War, an image of unrelenting coercion and pressure leading to the Soviet Union cracking, that I think is deeply at odds with the reality of what happened, and has in many ways led us astray, it seems to me, about the most productive way in which we are likely to promote democratic change, say in a place like Iran or Cuba, which I think is not unrelenting pressure and coercion and no engagement, but I think is in fact quite intense engagement. So we can try to show, as Reagan and Schultz so effectively showed Gorbachev, that we are not a threat, but that we also there are great potential benefits in working with us. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Peter, thank you. That was a brilliant start, and I think already we would have material for a very robust round for the next hour. Mm. And I'm tempted to move us right into the fray, but we won't. We'll be restrained and go right to Bob Kagan, who is invited both to present, but also, if you wish, Bob, start commenting on Peter's comments.
Well, I'll pass up the opportunity to comment on Peter's comments. First of all, let me just say that I think that this report that's been produced by all your organizations is extremely important because if there's one thing that wasn't supposed to be true after the end of the Cold War, it was the indefinite survival, if not flourishing, of autocratic regimes. Peter mentioned academic opinion. Academic opinion was almost unanimous that autocracy was a thing of the past. That there was no way in the modern era of global economics and market forces that modernization on the economic front wouldn't be accompanied by modernization on the political front. That is the entire premise behind the strategy, which Peter is calling for, of engagement with China. The idea is that as long as China keeps moving forward economically, the political liberalization of China must, almost as a law of human physics, must accompany it. And what this report points out, and a few others have pointed out, but which has been very, I must say, there's not been a great deal of receptivity to this point, is that quite the contrary, there is no such law of human physics, and at least for the foreseeable future, and I mean the long foreseeable future, it seems that economic growth and a degree of economic modernization are entirely compatible with continuing autocracy. And as this report points out, the wealth that is acquired as a result of economic modernization can be used as a tool of maintaining autocracy, both as a means of buying off public acquiescence to lack of freedom, but also as a means of using new tools of technology, new tools of communications, new tools of more intelligent repression than fire hoses or truncheons that manage to isolate people and keep them from raising any kind of challenge. China is the great model of success. It is a model that Vladimir Putin very eagerly is trying to copy, offering the same kind of bargain as long as it lasts, of increasing economic prosperity in return for decreasing political openness. And so as we look around the world, we see, much to our surprise, the continuing vitality of autocratic government long after it was supposed to have withered away by the natural forces of political and economic development. The report also points out, as I've also pointed out and others have pointed out, that these autocratic regimes do not exist in isolation from one another. They are, in fact, cooperating on many different planes in the international system. The most obvious is the protection that they afford each other in international fora, whether it is international human rights fora at the UN or on issues that are entirely unrelated to human rights, like nonproliferation, the protection that they afford fellow autocracies in Iran and North Korea, as well as Zimbabwe, as well as Sudan. Now, we all say, well, why, you know, why are they doing this? And I don't know why we would ever expect them to do anything else. It is not the business of autocracies to help democracies undermine other autocracies. The Chinese know perfectly well what it's like to be on the receiving end of the liberal democratic world's pressure. For them, Tiananmen Square, although they don't want to talk about it in public, is very much in the forefront of their minds at all time, as it is in the minds of other autocracies. And they know that they dare not allow the liberal democratic world to set further precedents that any kind of pressure or intervention or interference in the internal affairs of autocracies is acceptable. And so when I hear the argument that we need to work with Russia on nonproliferation, we need them to help us with nonproliferation. Therefore, we have to turn at least a partially blind eye to their domestic politics. When I hear that we need to work with the Chinese, we can't exclude them. We need to work with them on nonproliferation. I say, have we not seen the record? The record is one of consistent Russian and Chinese protection of the very regimes that we are trying to seek their assistance on. And I think the reason we ignore this reality is because we don't want to pay attention to the fact that autocracies have interests as autocracies, not just as particular nations with particular geopolitical interests, but as autocracies. And it's the unwillingness to face up to this fact that I think has led to a lot of confusion in our foreign policy and does so today. Now, the final thing that I'd like to say is, if autocracy is showing signs of flourishing these days, we should not only view this as the failure of a certain model or just maybe, you know, this is the way things are. I think we ought to recognize that we are helping autocracies flourish, and we're helping them in several ways. One has been by denigrating democracy itself. And let's not kid ourselves. We talk about how, the report talks about how the authoritarian governments have tried to redefine democracy or shape our perceptions of democracy. How about our own intellectual class? Our own intellectual class, which has spent more than a decade denigrating democracy, writing extensively about what is called illiberal democracy, which, by the way, we used to call autocracy. You know, so the Somozas won a series of elections. I guess they were just a long-running illiberal democracy. Now, not only denigrating illiberal democracy, but celebrating this wonderful phrase, liberal autocracy. The idea that you can count on these great autocratic leaders eventually, like Moses, to lead their countries across to the promised land. And guess what? They don't do it except by mistake. And if anyone thinks that Mikhail Gorbachev knew what he was doing as he lost control first of the internal and then of the external situation in the Soviet Union, then there really needs to be a little bit more historical reading done. But the bottom line is, autocrats are in the business of maintaining themselves in power. They are not in the business of helping a transition away from them. And so the notion that there is such a thing as a liberal autocrat is false. Finally, there is the question that we are helping them by refusing to respond. Yes, autocracies are flourishing. Yes, they are working together. Yes, in various ways they are promoting autocracy elsewhere in the world, and anyone who doesn't understand that can read this report and can read other reports about how Russia does use its wealth to fund like-minded peoples in neighboring countries. China does less of that, but the day may come when they will do it. Certainly, perhaps unintentionally, but certainly with great effect, the aid they provide to African dictatorships without raising any questions about how they use that money does not serve the cause of democracy, but in fact objectively supports autocracy. And what is our response to any of this? Now, I think that Congressman Hastings talked about the democracies getting together. I must say, anytime, and I have personal experience with this, anyone talks about the idea of the democracies getting together, a huge hue and cry is raised about what a terrible thing that would be. For anyone who's ever been in the business of promoting a concert of democracies or a league of democracies, as I have had the unfortunate experience of doing, I can tell you that I get more criticism from democracies, people who live in democracies, than from people who live in autocracies, oddly enough. And the reason is we dare not exclude them. We dare not draw a line between the democracies of the world and the autocracies of the world, because then they'll feel excluded and will create a division in this world. Well, let me tell you something. The division is already there. They are aware of it. They know that their interests don't coincide with ours. They are cooperating. They are spending their money. And the only thing that's not happening is that we're not. And I think that we ought to get back in the business of doing that, because let's not kid ourselves about this either. The world swings in pendulums between different forms of government. And it depends on what the strongest powers in the world do and are. There was a time when fascism looked like it was the new thing. When fascism looked like it was successful in the 1920s and 30s, you had little fascist dictatorships popping up in the strangest places in the world. When communism looked like it was winning, you had communist revolutions popping up everywhere, people declaring themselves communists. When democracy seemed to be the big winner after the end of the Cold War, you had a flourishing of democracy, and now the pendulum is swinging back again, and it can swing further. And we can live in a world that is more and more populated by autocratic governments, a world that we thankfully escaped from the 20th century, but which out of ignorance or lack of will or lack of concern, we may be sliding back to. So I do think there is a lot to be done, and I want to thank again the organizers of this conference and the institutions who have organized this conference for the work that they do, because I think it's extremely important and, in fact, increasingly important. Thanks.
Bob, thank you very much. And Peter, I thought maybe when Bob was going after Gorbachev, losing control, an inadvertent crisis, collapse, maybe he was coming after you, but not there, or not yet.
I sense that as well.
Okay. but I said not yet.
It's purely incidental.
So, and I think you're already ready to punch back, and he hasn't punched yet. Jim, over to you. You have the floor, please.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff, and I'm delighted to be here, and I'm going to gratify Jeff's wishes by taking on some of the things Bob said. But I also wanted to talk a little bit about the report, which I also have a somewhat different take on from Bob, and I come from the side of democracy promotion, as you can tell from the title of my book. And there are a couple. I agree that this is a bad thing, this autocratic backlash, and I agree that it exists. I am not as persuaded as the report is that it is as grave a danger as is pointed out. I am not as persuaded about the causes of it, at least the ones the paper identifies. So first, the premise that there is a global political recession, that is to say democracy on the retreat, autocracy on the rise. Proof, Freedom House figures have gone backwards in terms of democracy for 3 years. Well, the broad political dynamics we're talking about cannot be measured in 3 years. This is not like inflation or unemployment statistics. If you go back a little bit longer, if you go back over, let's say, a decade, you'll find that the Freedom House figures show a slightly greater number of countries advancing than diminishing. So just in terms of raw numbers, I don't accept this premise, and I think it would be terrible if it were so. I don't think it is so. Thinking that it is so, though, tends to lead very much to the view that Bob expressed here and in his book, which is to say that increasingly salient is this distinction in the world between the democratic states and the autocratic states. Now, I have to say that doesn't correspond to my sense of the world. And I would say it doesn't in two important ways. One that Bob raised where I just don't really agree, that is to say the increasingly inescapable need for states to cooperate on a set of issues that don't very much distinguish them according to their internal regime type, whether it is the global financial crisis or non-proliferation or climate change. Two, I think that the distinctions between Western democracies and third world democracies are every bit as salient as the distinction between democracies and non-democracies. And in fact, one reason why I am one of those democracy-promoting people who does not believe in a concert of democracies is that I think it rests in part upon the assumption that democratic states will behave similarly in terms of a set of key foreign policy issues. Well, non-Western democratic states, India, South Africa, Brazil, Mexico, the leading emerging nation democracies, they don't look at the world that way. They don't denominate their own foreign policy in terms of the fact that they're a democracy or not. And Jeff mentioned that I also work with this NGO called the Global Center for the Responsibility to Protect, which focuses on this principle of responsibility to protect, which is the reformulated version of humanitarian intervention. And I can tell you that for us, India, the countries I just mentioned, in fact, India, Brazil, South Africa, are obstacles that I would say in many ways are more formidable than Russia or China. So I'm not comfortable with this distinction. I think more is being made of it than is the case. Then there's the question of the cause. That is to say, how important in this supposed backlash is this increasingly joined up struggle on the part of autocracies to, in effect, promote autocracy. And I thoroughly accept the fact that it exists, and I think the great thing about the report is that it highlights that. But how important is that? For example, if you look at Latin America, how important is Chavez's autocracy promotion in terms of establishing a beachhead for non-democratic government in Bolivia, I guess also in Ecuador? I mean, this is an area where my knowledge is secondhand and I'm eager to be corrected by anybody who knows the region, unlike me. My impression is that both capitalism and democracy are on shaky foundations in parts of Latin America because they're seen as not having worked. That is to say, capitalism is identified with neoliberal formulas, which rightly or wrongly is seen as having actually made things worse, not better in Latin America. And countries like Venezuela, which really did have electoral democracies, did have a free press until Chavez came along and overthrew them to the great grief of Venezuela, my impression is, also had a politics built in the same kind of oligarchic social structure that you find in so many parts of Latin America. And democracy by ordinary people was perceived as a kind of ping pong game between different branches of the elite. And so I am more inclined to think that the failure of democracies to consolidate themselves and the failure of democracies to deliver has more to do with this backsliding that people perceive than this successful kind of propaganda campaign waged by autocratic states. And I think it's also important to look at the other side. Why is the Chinese leadership so popular in China? Why did 90% of the Chinese people say that they're satisfied with their political leadership? Well, the report says, because the same Communist Party leadership produced a situation so catastrophic that the contrast with today is fantastic. Who wouldn't be satisfied? And I think that must be true. But that seems like a kind of niggling and unsatisfactory explanation for an astonishing economic miracle, which has come at the cost of total political repression. You can read Nick Kristof's op-ed piece in Today's Times, talking about the horror of Tiananmen Square, which he was present at, and then saying, but why don't people care about it anymore? And he said, repression, fear, but also this astonishing economic miracle. So one has to reckon with that success. I wouldn't say that, by the way, of Russia, Iran, or Venezuela. I would say it of China. China has a very powerful model in that regard. So in that sense, I'm uncomfortable with this paradigm of fearful democracies, bold autocracies, and that line moving between them. Now, what should Obama do? And I'm struck that Peter and Bob both use the word engagement, but in a very different sense. In a very different sense. So Peter used the engagement, as I understand it, in the sense that if we accept the legitimacy of other countries' sense of their own interests and deal with them on the respectful basis of that, we don't agree with you, but we recognize that this is your view and that in some ways it corresponds to your own situation, we will have more, we will get somewhere diplomatically. Bob used it in a very specific political science sense, which is the belief that if you can incorporate countries into the global economy, they will eventually become democracies, so we should do whatever we can to help China develop and they'll become a democracy, a belief that he rightly pointed out has been proved to be false. But I don't think a belief that is so widely held anymore. It was a widely held belief. It was a credo. And like a lot of credos about democratic development, it's proved to be wrong. So I don't know that that is so. But now this engagement question, though, I think goes much more to what President Obama, pardon me, at least thinks he's doing, which is engaging with everybody, engaging with countries which people on the left have urged engagement with, Cuba, engaging with countries which people on the left wouldn't have wanted engagement with, China. Now, the premise, I take it, of this is that if we engage with them, we will get these good things that Bob has said is naive. And that may prove to be so. I mean, let's take an example. Obama's attempt to create a strong coalition against North Korea, to enlist Russia and China, to finally forcefully say to North Korea, this can't stand, ought to be, he hopes it will be, I suppose, one of the fruits of this engagement with Russia and China. Is it going to work? I don't know. Jury's out. In the case of Cuba, engagement with Cuba has already produced a kind of sea change in the Organization of American States, which has had an increasingly conflictual relationship with the United States in recent years. So I think the premise is, if we engage with everybody, good things will happen. We have no choice but to engage with autocrats because we need them to build these structures that President Bush utterly ignored on nonproliferation and climate change. We need Egypt because it's a partner for peace, et cetera, et cetera. Now, I'll say a few more things, then stop. Several really fundamental questions arise. One, is it right that you have to make a trade-off? Do you have to say to President Mubarak, as we have said, our aid to you will no longer be conditioned on political reform, and thereby we hope that you will be a better partner for peace? I'm not persuaded of that. I was really dismayed by that. I think that was a mistake. I would be willing to take that risk because, one, Mubarak hasn't delivered very much. Two, I don't think he's going to change his own self-interest based on the fact that we are making demands for internal reform. On the other hand, is it good that we engaged with Cuba in the way that we did, even though Cuba remains an autocratic state? I think, yeah, I think maybe there's a trade-off there too. Diplomacy is choosing, and democracy promotion is a fundamental thing in that balance. It is one thing. It is not the thing, especially given that we realize the limits of what we can do. So I don't know how this will play out over time. My possibly vain hope is that Obama has downplayed the language I would have liked to have heard from him, and I think all of you would have liked to have heard from him about democracy, in the hope and expectation of repairing a lot that was broken in recent years, and thereby creating a foundation which will allow him to use the language and maybe use the policies that would further the cause of democracy in the world. That's my guess. I mean, it may be that, in fact, they're so allergic to Bush's language, and Obama is so deeply aware of the danger of America arrogantly preaching or promoting anything, that, in fact, he will retreat into a much more classically realist world. But I think the one thing I would say is that I am more willing to accept that the trade-offs that he appears to be seeking are in the name of things profoundly worth attaining than I was when the Bush administration effectively abandoned its democracy promotion policy starting around 2006 or so because it felt that it needed to enlist states in the global war on terror and it saw that there was a tension between them. So I guess in that sense I am both dismayed by the lack of democracy language so far in the administration, but I am still I'm broadly hopeful about this administration's ambitions, and therefore I'm at least hopeful that it will incorporate a deep concern about democracy.
Jim, thank you very much, and Congressman.
Congressman Hastings, thank you very much. I would like to try to connect at least one thread between Peter and Jim, and I'm going to pose a question to two of them and then a separate but related question to Bob. Jim, Peter raised the question about what you do when authoritarians deliver the goods, and you said, Peter, as I understood you, that China is an example, and it's a challenging example. And Jim, if I understood you correctly, you pointed to an apparent lack of widespread interest or energy or dynamism behind human rights or rule of law or democracy in China. My question to both of you is, how do you know? How do you know what Chinese think? And let me give you an admittedly very imperfect analogy, but nevertheless just to push the conversation along. In 1988, in East Germany, you still had the Honecker regime in power, and in West Germany in 1988, a year before the Berlin Wall fell, it was pretty much conventional wisdom on left and right, in the academic community, in the journalistic community, that East Germany had evolved to a kind of mild authoritarianism. It wasn't a democracy, but a mild authoritarianism. Economically, they're doing quite well, it was said. It was the crown jewel of the Soviet Empire, far better than the other Soviet bloc countries. And it was stable because there was no Solidarity and there was no Václav Havel and Charter 77. And then within a year, that vanished. And all those assumptions were turned on their head. How do you make assumptions, the big country, it's not a monolith, but nevertheless, perhaps you first, Jim, how do you make assumptions about what Chinese want today and what they are or are not satisfied with?
Well, it's a fair question, because obviously any kind of survey taken in an autocratic state is going to be less dependable than one taken in a democratic state. I don't actually know who's done these surveys. I'd be very happy if, you know, IRI or you know, others did them, as opposed to I don't know whom. My impression is that, first of all, survey data bears this out. Second, why shouldn't people feel this way? That is to say, there has never been a case in human history in which so many people were lifted out of poverty so quickly. Now, we rightly deplore the political cost of that and say those political costs did not have to be paid. But it is nevertheless a fact that for tens or hundreds of millions of Chinese people, their economic prospects, their educational prospects, their fundamental life prospects have changed with astonishing speed. That can't be said of the East Germans, not in the least. And so the reason why I think Peter rightly said that China is a more dangerous model is that communism failed on its own terms. It didn't give people a better life. China, however, has succeeded at that most fundamental of goals.
Peter?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say, I mean, I'll go with you in saying that we can't assume because the Chinese government is still in power, or because they can mobilize lots of people at a rally, that means that everybody is happy with the Chinese government. I think your point is well taken. That often, you know, as the famous line goes, a democracy is like a rickety raft, and an autocracy is like a proud sailing ship that all of a sudden hits a raft and sinks because you can't see what's going on under the surface. But I think it's also very important that we not assume, which I think sometimes we still do, that the Eastern European analogy is apt, that because people in East Germany had a deep hostility to their regime, in fact their entire state, which they wanted to collapse, therefore we should assume the same in China. As Jim said, China has produced really enormous material benefits for the people. East Germany is a state that actually would have ceased to exist had they not built a wall to keep the people in. Because although East Germany was better than Albania and Romania, but it was far, far, far less economically successful than West Germany. East Germany also was under the imperial control of a foreign power, which was to say that East German nationalism was essentially a vehicle against a regime that was seen to be a puppet of a hated foreign power. The situation in China is very different. In some ways, you can argue Chinese nationalism is much more dangerous for that reason, but it also means that it can be used much more effectively against us. That Chinese nationalism, that we may be the object of Chinese nationalism, whereas in East Germany, the object of Chinese nationalism was the Soviet Union. I think that means that is a very fundamental difference between the two situations, which is likely to have an impact on the ability of a regime to use nationalism to gain the support of its people in a way that I think East Germany was not able to do.
Peter, thank you. Bob, if I may, I recall reading somewhere a little story. It may have been apocryphal, but I like the story, so I use it anyway, that when Reagan first met Gorbachev, he smiled warmly, shook his hand, leaned in, and said, "Let me explain to you why we don't trust you." And, of course, it wasn't Gorbachev personally. He was trying to communicate that you have a system that doesn't have free and competitive press and doesn't have fair and free elections and doesn't have independent courts and doesn't have independent trade unions and so on. My question to you is, why does it have to be a proposition of either engagement or coercion, understanding that country to country it may be a different strategy, but pick a country like Iran. Why can one not approach a country like Iran in an integrated fashion where the dialogue tends to security issues, the nuclear program, but also cares for human rights and democracy?
Well, I think the obvious answer is that it can and should. The history has been turned into a cartoon. It's not as if we didn't have engagement with the Soviet Union throughout almost the entire period of the Cold War. The only person who refused to negotiate with the Soviet Union was Peter's friend Dean Acheson, the great model of modern liberalism. But
not actually my good friend.
I'm sorry. And I think that if you were to tell me that our engagement with China was going to include very consistent criticism of their human rights record, as it did to some extent during the Clinton years, the Clinton administration for a while managed to combine a pretty tough posture on human rights with engagement. Now, ultimately, the business interests overruled the human rights interests, but there can be a balance, and I would be very happy to see that restored, rather than, for instance, the new and wonderful administration declaring that we're never going to let human rights get in the way of our relationship, which I don't consider to be the kind of engagement that I think is right. And certainly in the case of Iran, I think that we ought to be able to do all of that. I mean, think back on the Cold War, and I've had this conversation with Europeans many times. They're very proud of the fact, and their view is that it's really the Helsinki Accords that brought down the Soviet Union. Now, I always have to laugh when I hear them say that, but nevertheless, at least it's a nice thought. And so I say, well, why don't, with dealing with Putin's Russia, don't we have a Helsinki process with Putin's Russia then? I mean, that obviously was not, you don't consider that to have been either futile or contradictory during the Soviet Union. But the fact is, we are pretty much in the position of having a very unquestioning approach now. Certainly, we did during the Bush administration, and the Clinton and the Obama administration has merely continued it. I must say, now that the Obama administration has tried to policy practice of engagement with China, do we really think this is a new policy? Do we really think that the Obama administration is doing anything with regard to China that Bush didn't do for 8 years? It's not as if we don't have a track record here. So what we do have a track record of increasingly forgetting about the dimension that you're talking about, Jeff.
Bob, thank you. And before I open it up to the audience, I'd like to ask, if I may, Peter and Jim, one last question. It seems to me, Peter and Jim, and I'm going to stay with Iran for a second, the question now is not whether we engage or not, but the quality and kind of engagement. Could you make a comment about what you would like to see and what you would recommend? And may I ask you, do you have concern that when the administration speaks about engagement with Iran, that perhaps they mean the government, not the people of Iran, and one issue, the nuclear issue, and not a broader set of issues? Peter first, and then Jim.
The first thing I would say is I think actually if you read Obama's speech in Cairo today, I think it's actually hard to suggest that he's abandoned the democracy, at least rhetorically. I mean, it may not be at quite the same level that it was at the height of the Bush administration for a brief moment, but I think it's I would imagine it actually probably compares pretty favorably just on a rhetorical level to where Bush was, as Jim said, after 2006. I think what's different is how much additional emphasis he puts on things like strengthening the nuclear nonproliferation regime for all countries or reciprocity in the Arab-Israeli peace process. Yes, it is nice to say that we can do it all, that we can basically that we can engage with countries and still pressure them as well. Yet foreign policy is also about priorities. I mean, foreign policy is about difficult choices, sometimes about priorities, about which issues on your agenda matter the most. I mean, maybe it'll make Bob happy to hear me bash the Carter administration a little bit, but one of the things that people have faulted about the Carter administration was an unwillingness to prioritize. I think you can say the Reagan administration had quite different priorities at different moments in Reagan's presidency, but at each moment you can argue there was a clear set of priorities. And I actually think by the end of the Reagan administration, promoting democracy in the Soviet Union was not actually priority number one. That arms control was priority number one, although arms control in a certain way served that latter purpose. Reagan really abandoned a lot of his hard-line rhetoric towards Gorbachev in those last few years. So I'm not saying that we should abandon calls for democracy and pressure on democratization, but I think one has to be honest and forthright in talking about, well, what are you willing to give up if that kind of pressure is likely to mean that you get less cooperation on other things? And I think that's the kind of hard-headed conversation one has. And I'm willing to – I would be happier were people willing to say, yes, the pressure on democracy is so important that we're willing to do it, even if it means that we get less, for instance – that we're less likely to get help from Iran on restraining Hezbollah, for instance. This is more important to us. Or even if it means that there's less likelihood that we're going to have success in reaching some kind of nuclear deal. We don't know that the democratic pressure is going to mean that there's less likelihood of success, but I think it would be really flippant to just assume that we can always have our cake and eat it too.
Jim.
Well, Peter said just about everything that I was going to say, so I'll just say it all over again. No, I think that Iran is actually a really well-chosen example in that sense, because on the one hand, it's a very strange totalitarian state, but among other things, it is a totalitarian state. And if you have ever been in Iran, you would you it's heartbreaking that a country that really has everything is being kept under the thumb of these medievalists. So it's hard to think of a place where we have a deeper interest in and wish for democratic change. Also one where we have very little capacity to actually make a difference right now. The difference between what we would wish for and what we are capable of in terms of Iran's internal political dynamic is enormous. On the other hand, Iran's capacity to do mischief in the world is immense. Our ability to do something about Iran's capacity to do mischief in the world is greater, I think, than our capacity to influence its internal dynamic. And so in this world of choices that Peter was just describing, it's very understandable that we would say, look, let's focus on the thing that matters hugely that we might be able to do something about, which is their support for Hezbollah and Hamas, and of course the nuclear non-proliferation issue. I have very low expectations of success, but I think it is right to try. I also just want to correct a wrong impression that I must have left given Bob's response. I don't think that the Bush administration didn't engage with China, and the Obama administration is doing so. I don't think the differences are actually very important at all. I'm trying to explain to myself, in a way, what I think was the rationale for Hillary's, I think, wrong-headed comment when she went there, that we're not going to let human rights get in the way of all this stuff. It does go to a different Bush administration failure, which is the unwillingness to build the kinds of structures, institutions, networks and so on, which we are going to need in the world we are moving into on issues where we cannot do it without China, the ones I've already mentioned, which whatever you may think about China, we can't get there without them.
Thank you. Now, we have the balance of 25 minutes for questions and comments from the audience, and I'll go to Martha Bayless first, and if you would stand, identify yourself and say a word. Identify yourself, Martha.
This has been an interesting discussion because the entire focus of your remarks, it seems to me, has been on conventional diplomacy, government to government, discussing democratic agenda as something that diplomats press on other diplomats in a mixture of other issues. But the sponsoring organizations behind this event have focused almost all of their attention historically on American attempts to communicate with the populations of other countries. Radio Free Asia was founded in parallel with this reversion to doing business as usual with China, in my understanding, as a kind of parallel track. We push the human rights agenda through this kind of broadcasting effort at the same time that we are engaging the government for opening Chinese markets and all that other good stuff. There's more than one America out there engaging the world. And I'd just be interested to hear, particularly from these organizations sponsoring this event, can engagement with the population of other countries, with civil society, with democratic organizations and efforts, parallel a different kind of engagement with the government to further these other issues that really do not require necessarily the support of the population?
Martha, thank you. Can everybody, including in the back, hear that question? You're saying no. Well, I'm not repeating it. I would say that there are eight chairs in the front row. Please come forward. Bob, would you take that first, please?
It's kind of authoritarian, isn't it?
Well, obviously, it's true. But it raises a question. I believe someone told me before I got up here that the Obama administration has just canceled Freedom House's civil society program in Egypt. Is that true? Yes. Yeah, how about that? And I think that while I'm entirely sympathetic to the idea that the American government can go in one direction while some of these non-governmental organizations go in another, I must say that I fear that the weight of the American government's position is greater even than these than the efforts of the organizations that are represented here, especially if, as seems to be the case, the American government is going to cancel civil society programs being conducted by these kinds of organizations. And I must say, it certainly raises questions about the rhetorical power of President Obama's statements in Egypt, if in Egypt he has canceled the civil society program.
Jim, feel free to take up that, but also the broader question, is this just government to government? How does one more effectively engage peoples
and
populations?
Well, a couple things. One, I think Bob is surely right that what states say and what states do so totally shape the environment that you can't imagine that it's somehow going to be counteracted by something else. But I do think there's a couple things to be said on this. There's actually a worse example in Egypt than the one Bob mentioned, which is that the Obama administration has agreed that it will no longer direct funding to NGOs in Egypt which are not licensed by the state, or registered, I think is the term. And, of course, they only register ones that are entirely compliant. So I think that's really, I mean, as an act of truckling to Mubarak, I think that sends a really terrible signal. Now, we're operating on a couple different questions. One is the value of public diplomacy, which is to say a president or others speaking to individuals. Clearly, that's what Obama just did in Cairo. So he is someone who is acutely aware of himself as an instrument of public diplomacy, and I would say we've never had a more powerful one. So for better or for worse, depending on what he says, he's going to be our instrument. In terms of civil society, though, a word that everybody loves to use, I do think actually as a fundamental instrument in the world of democracy promotion, it's really key that all this stuff we do, as much as possible, not be done by the State Department or USAID or an actual instrument of government, but in fact be done through civil society, through NGOs. And in fact, the NED and IRI and so forth effectively are NGOs for all their semi-public status. But also the role of the Open Society Institute and so on is terribly important. And the promotion of interlocutors on the other side, the promotion of civil society in other countries, it is an absolutely indispensable prerequisite for the development of democracy.
Jim, thank you. Before I give you the floor, Peter, I just want to mention as an aside to Martha's broader point that, of course, what Libya and Radio Free Asia does and what we do, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, what we do has this awkward label, but it's always been called surrogate broadcasting. It's not imposing anything. It's not dictating anything. It's not the editorial line of the United States government. It is independent journalism, and it's actually stipulated legally. It's independent, and it's providing the news and information, discussion, debate, and analysis that countries would have if they had a free press, or in countries that don't have a fully developed or mature free and independent press. We in our work, as you know, Martha, see evidence all the time, and sometimes the instances can be seemingly small, but I think kind of powerful, that when you do find ways and methods to engage populations, it can have great effect. And I'll just mention just one small one. I've just come in from Prague. That's where our operational headquarters is. Our Afghan service that has 55% audience share in Afghanistan. It's the most popular station in the country. It does music, news, health care, culture, satire. They just told me that they had a call-in with some disabled students in Kabul. Very simple. They call in and they say, we have exams next week at the university and there's no handicap access. And then when that's on the air, a minister gets on the air from the Afghan government and says, well, we didn't know about that. We'll fix it. But then equally important comes a debate about handicapped students and handicap and issues and values of diversity and tolerance and inclusion and so forth. Sometimes it's direct. Sometimes it's less direct. To you, Peter, I'm not asking you to compliment what we do, but you're invited to. But I would ask you to take from what Jim said, what else can be done? You've made an argument against coercion, and you've made an argument on behalf of engagement. You've said that priorities are required, and that point is taken. But in societies, pick one or speak broadly, what else can the United States do through government, to Martha's question, outside of government, to have a richer engagement and support for civil society in a number of these countries?
Well, I think one of the most crucial things we can do is to make it easy, perhaps easier than it has been in the recent years, for foreign students to come to the United States. I think that and my colleague at the Council on Foreign Relations, Ted Alden, has written a book about this. I think we're overcoming some of the worst mistakes that we made after 9/11. But I think the enormous series of difficulties and obstacles that was created to foreign students coming to the United States after 9/11, particularly from the Muslim world, I think looks in retrospect very, very self-defeating. It's really, really, I think there's nothing better than we can do than to have large numbers of those people, young people from the Muslim world and from other authoritarian parts of countries come to the United States. And if we divert them away from the United States and they end up studying not in the U.S. but in the Gulf, for instance, instead, or in China, I think they will have a very different set of experiences, and I think we should make every effort, even at the cost of marginally increasing the threat of terrorism, to make sure that we remain relatively open.
Let's take a next question. This gentleman, if you come to the microphone, then we'll all hear.
Eli Lake, Washington Times, for the panel. In the current war against terror networks, the U.S. relies upon security services that also serve to prop up unfree countries. So how can the U.S. credibly support democracy promotion and at the same time cooperate? I think New York Times has written that Obama's increasingly outsourcing hard cases to these security services. So how can the government do both in a credible sense when oftentimes our allies in the war on terrorism are also propping up and responsible for the direct repression of the authoritarian and autocracies?
Eli, thank you. Bob, could you take that first? Double standards, hypocrisy.
Well, I think the two Obama people should probably answer it first, since it's their problem now. It's not mine. But I'm happy to answer it.
Are you a Bush person at that logic?
No, I haven't actually spent all my time talking about how wonderful one candidate or one president is. I've just talked about America. But anyway,
he's no longer in office.
It's okay. Look, as a practical matter, it is in fact perfectly possible to cooperate with these oppressive groups and overthrow their government at the same time. We did it in Latin America. We certainly had good people-to-people relations with intelligence organizations in Central and South America at the same time as we were sort of gradually on our own fumbling way, making it increasingly difficult for their governments to survive. So most of these services are not doing us a favor when they cooperate on anti-terrorist stuff. They're mostly doing it themselves anyway. And so I think it's possible. It shouldn't be a hindrance. But I don't want to remove the glaring contradiction that you're pointing up for my colleagues here.
Well, Bob, before we leave you and go to the others, what about a country like Pakistan, which is authoritarian? And I'm going back to what Peter said. Peter didn't use Pakistan as an example, but so essential on the war on terror, it is authoritarian. We do require and need stability there. We do cooperate with security forces that are really quite illiberal. Does that hurt our cause or undermine our credibility there or elsewhere?
Well, it has, and it hasn't paid off either. I mean, this is the great irony. And, I feel like I'm back in the Cold War again in some respects, especially when I hear Peter's argument for why you have to sometimes cooperate with these authoritarian governments and not put too much pressure on them one way or another. Guess what? That was the argument in the Cold War. That's why you didn't want to put too much pressure on Pinochet, and that's why you didn't want to put too much pressure on the South Korean government, and that's why you didn't want to put too much pressure on any authoritarian government, because after all, we need them for this and we need them for that. And it turns out to be a mistake in the long run. And certainly in the case of Pakistan, so we had this wonderful relationship with the very same people who were supporting the very same people that we are now fighting and who are trying to kill us. And they are part of the problem. So what was the payoff exactly for this cooperation? And I think that we should, if the Cold War taught us anything, it's that this clinging to people who claim to be our allies in a certain struggle, lest if we don't support them, we get this terrible alternative. That turned out to be a mistaken policy in the Cold War, and I think it's a mistaken policy in the present situation, too. We would be better off if we have less dependence and less solidarity with especially with the security intelligence services of Pakistan than we had all through the Bush years, I want to make it clear, unquestioningly. And I hope that that is one of the things that changes, although I'm not sure, given what I'm hearing, that that is one of the things that will change under the Obama administration, since, after all, we have to work with these people. So,
Bob, thank you. Let me go next to Secretary Beinart of the Obama administration for a comment.
If I'm not mistaken, there's only one person on this panel who actually worked for a presidential candidate in the last election, and it wasn't Jim or me.
So I don't have to worry about
what happened. And for the record, I also find, although I don't know enough about the details, the move on Egypt to be troubling, like Jim, just to make clear that I don't approve of everything Barack Obama does. But I think, again, Bob is just not willing to acknowledge any trade-offs whatsoever. We can always have our cake and eat it too. We can, and I just think that just flies in the face of reality. I mean, the Cold War is not the story that he tells. The United States was very smart to open to China in the early 1970s, even though China was a far, far more vicious, nasty, brutal, totalitarian place than it is today. We gained important results. We were smart to be engaged with Yugoslavia when we saw opportunities to basically pry it away from the Soviet bloc under Tito. The story of us in our policies towards Latin America as, well, we were sometimes incompetent and fumbling, but basically the major thrust was basically pushing countries towards democracy. I mean, you know, tell that to the Chileans and the Guatemalans. We were often not a force. We were often a force against democracy because we perceived it to be in our interest to be that way, and that was partly because we had a very long-standing idea that we couldn't allow foreign, which was hegemonic on the American right, certainly, that we could not allow foreign powers to get a base in our hemisphere. So these trade-offs are real and they're ugly, and I don't think we can just shy away from them so easily. I think what we have to do is see how much leverage other countries have over us. I mean, one of the reasons it seems to me what Obama's doing in Egypt doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me is I don't think the Egyptians have a lot of leverage over us. I think the Iranians have more. We need more from the Iranians that they could be happy not giving us. I don't see what the Egyptians' alternative is. I think they need this terrorism cooperation with us because they're at least as threatened, and I don't see another place for them else to go. So I think we do have some opportunity to use leverage on Egypt, but in other cases we may not. And if we're going to risk our relationship with these security services because we're going to put more pressure on the democracy, then we have to have a serious conversation about how concerned we are about these people, these terrorist threats. I mean, we may need to ratchet down the level of fear we have about some of these terrorist suspects if we're willing to create a circumstance in which we're not going to have the intelligence cooperation. And that may be another conversation we need to have.
Peter, thank you. Jim, comment as you wish, but don't forget Eli Lake's original question. Do I summarize it correctly, Eli? How do we promote democracy and fight the war on terror at the same time? Is that more or less?
Fight the war on terror through proxy services.
Okay, thank you.
You know, I'll actually try to answer it specifically because Eli's question reminded me of an incident in, I guess, late 2004 in Sudan. U.S. Congress had just declared that Sudan was committing genocide in Darfur. Several months later, it turned out that the CIA had brought the head of the chief security service in Sudan, who was part and parcel of the machine of genocide, to Langley for a series of high-level secret conferences, spirited them in and spirited them out so that nobody would know that we were having truck with this genocidal figure because Sudan had very cleverly positioned itself on our side immediately after 9/11 and turned over all sorts of records to us. They were actually quite useful. And so there you would say, well, yes, here is the global war on terror overtly trumping the deepest human rights concerns, which, in fact, the Bush administration was quite good on, better than anybody else when it came to Sudan. I find it hard to believe that was the right call. And so in the sense of trade-offs that Peter was talking about, there is no one answer to your question. There are a set of priorities you have which have various weight. I mean, Pakistan that Bob raised is a perfect example.
Probably for the first 3 or 4 years of General Musharraf's reign, there was no terribly good reason for us to have pushed very hard for the restoration of democracy. One, the Pakistani people were so disgusted by the time he came along in 1999 with feckless democracy that they welcomed Musharraf. Musharraf was still popular. The economy was growing. He was Fareed Zakaria's favorite liberal autocrat, and so on. However, it became painfully clear by 2007 or so that this was not the case. One, Musharraf wasn't delivering to us what he had said he would deliver, and two, he wasn't delivering to the Pakistani people what he said he would deliver, and they rose up against him as one in what, to me, is the single greatest demonstration of constitutional faith and passion that the Islamic world has ever seen, when all of these lawyers and then hundreds of thousands of others took to the streets to demonstrate against him, and the Bush administration stayed on his side till the bitter end. That was a dumb trade-off. And so I think all one can say is that the weight one gives to these various things will determine the trade-offs one makes.
Jim, thank you. We are nearly out of time, but not quite. We're going to take two more, but take them together. And this gentleman here in the third row, and David, if you come to the microphone, we'll take them together, give the panelists a brief opportunity to reply, and then we'll go to coffee break.
Thank you. My name is Valery Zutsev. I am Muskie Fellow at the University of Maryland. And I'd like to deliver two messages, one optimistic and one pessimistic. Let me start with the pessimistic one. What the panelists, I think, are grappling with, and partly Mr. Traub has acknowledged, is the rise of a certain rise of realpolitik discourse in the politics recently, because what we've seen in the recent past has been the U.S. Saying basically, if you are a friend of the U.S., then we support your territorial integrity, like Georgia. If you are not, then let's have independent Kosovo. There has been a lot of talk about.
I have to say, if this is the first of two messages,
you have to edit yourself. That's it.
Okay.
But the second message, which is about Russia, things are not as bad, I think, in the Russian near abroad, so to say, because what countries like Ukraine and even Central Asian countries are about, they are actually looking for more U.S. presence there, not less. Except, of course, they don't perhaps want cheap alternative of EU membership or prospects of EU membership, like NATO membership, maybe, in countries like Ukraine. But they still are looking forward to more engagement with the U.S. rather than less. So, thank you.
Thank you. And final question.
Thanks. David Kramer with the German Marshall Fund of the United States, and I was, in the interest of disclosure, the last Assistant Secretary of State for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor in the Bush administration. And I'm not here to defend the Bush administration, but I am here to ask two questions as a result of the very interesting and provocative discussion by the panel. First, to Mr. Traub, you said India, South Africa, Mexico are more formidable than Russia and China. Could you explain that? I'm at a loss as to what you mean there. And to Peter Beinart, you, in talking about the President Obama's speech today in Egypt, were very enthusiastic and supportive of what he had to say on democracy and human rights, and you were very critical of the Bush administration after the Hamas election. And you said, if I understood you correctly, that the Bush administration said, we are not in favor of democracy anymore after that. I don't recall any statement being uttered along those lines. I do recognize, however, that the administration's support for democracy in the region declined significantly. I have vote. But if I could read you one sentence from the president's speech this morning. He said, "We will welcome all elected peaceful governments, provided they govern with respect for all their people." So my question is, if Hamas were to win the next election in Palestine, would the Obama administration's reaction be any different than the Bush administration's? Thanks.
David, thank you. I'm going to suggest we take it in exactly the order that you suggested, David, Jim, Peter, and Bob. And then why not, Bob, you as the among this group, the soft-headed idealist. You should probably have the last word in this democracy conference. Jim, you first.
Now it's on. Sorry. So the question about Russia. One quick thing, which is the Russians have this hobby horse, which says if Western countries could champion the freedom of Kosovo, why couldn't they recognize the need for Abkhazia and South Ossetia to be free? This is a very complicated hobby horse, which I won't go into here, but I think there were actually very good reasons why we favored the one and not the other. More broadly, the Russian near abroad is, in fact, a great skirmishing site for all of these democracy issues. And I don't think we should accept the premise that we supported Georgia because they're our friend and didn't support Russia because they're our enemy. No, it really mattered that Georgia was a democracy, a really flawed democracy with a lot of problems, like most democracies. But I thought it was very important that the Bush administration and also the Obama campaign and the McCain campaign, in to different degrees of intensity, made it clear that that mattered a lot. And I do worry that that's one place where the Obama administration will fall short in their approaches to Russia. They've already clearly downgraded Georgia, and that's a real source of concern. The other question is what I meant when I said that the emerging democracies are a bigger obstacle than Russia and China. I was speaking specifically of this question of this emerging norm of responsibility to protect, but it's similar to other human rights norms, which is we know that Russia and China are going to oppose them. We know that Russia and China will talk about sovereignty until they turn blue in the face. That is a given. But where the balance of opinion lies is where the major third world democracies come out on this. And if where they come out on this is basically the same thing, which is we mustn't do anything in Sri Lanka because it's Sri Lanka's own business, and that was how the Human Rights Council came out with the votes of either in favor of that view or abstaining from an alternative view of many democratic countries, including Japan, I'm sorry to say. So if the major emerging democracies take a view which is similar to that of the autocracies, that is kind of curtains for the hope for a genuinely universalized human rights regime.
Jim, thank you. Peter, as you make your concluding remark, do not forget that Bob has the last word, so don't be gentle.
Believe it or not, I think Bob and I are friends, but or at least yes, we were before this panel started. Hopefully, we'll be afterwards. I guess. Well, I think where we fundamentally disagree, and I think it goes to the first question, is basically about the question of whether states are more influenced by ideology or national interest. I mean, the way I look at the Cold War, shows that in fact national interest was more important. That's why China and the Soviet Union were at knife edge with one another, hated each other more than either hated the U.S. for a good part of the Cold War. It's why China and Vietnam went to war. It's why Yugoslavia and the Soviet Union hated each other's guts. And that was a very important understanding in our strategy in the Cold War. And that was countries that were linked by Marxism, which is a darn pretty coherent, well-developed body of ideology. As I understand what Bob is saying, he's basically saying that this much, much more loose, diffuse kind of authoritarianism that links links China and Russia and Iran and Venezuela, whose internal systems are actually dramatically different, is going to be so important that basically we should treat them as some kind of relatively unified bloc. And I think what he's saying in his own experiences when he finds people in the democracies who don't actually buy that view is that they perceive national interest to be a more powerful force, both within the authoritarian governments and, in fact, within the democracies as well, which I think is the point that Jim is making about the importance of national character and national history and why it leads a country like India and South Africa to see the world very differently than us, even though they're also democracies. Thank God they're democracies. The point I would just make on Hamas, I don't think I said that the Bush administration said it wasn't in favor of democracy. I mean, I think we all agree the Bush administration in general moved a little bit away from the democracy promotion agenda, partly because they realized they had less power over the countries of the Middle East than they thought they did at a certain moment in, say, 2003. I think we should acknowledge. My point about Hamas was, Hamas won the election. we set out three conditions. We basically will not accept the results of this election unless you forswear violence, you accept Israel's right to exist, and you abide by past agreements. Now, I would kiss the ground if Hamas did all those, and in fact, I might have been willing, I might have myself required a forswearing of violence. So I myself might not, am not a democracy purist. But I think, but the other two conditions in particular didn't actually have to do with the character of Hamas government in the Palestinian territories. They weren't really about whether they were going to be a truly democratic government. They were about how they dealt with Israel. And I think that was a mistake. I think we would have been better off essentially swallowing the very painful setback to Israeli-Palestinian peace that Hamas represented in order to be able to have credibility in saying that basically we support democratic elections even when they lead to governments that don't share our interests and that are a setback to our interests. And that way, I dare say, in fact, perhaps I'm the idealist on the panel.
Peter, thank you. Bob.
I'm so confused. I'm flabbergasted, or I can't speak, or something about in the interest of promoting a new liberal foreign policy, Peter has discovered his inner Richard Nixon. Every argument that I have heard made for why everybody understands there are trade-offs, and even I understand there are trade-offs, and there were trade-offs during the Cold War, but every argument that was used for why we shouldn't give Pinochet a hard time, for why we shouldn't give the South Korean government a hard time, they are no more or less valid than all the arguments that are being made now about why you shouldn't give Egypt a hard time and why you shouldn't give the Chinese a hard time. Guess what? There are always trade-offs. What I find ironic is that most people who call themselves liberals today, including, I dare say, probably Hillary Clinton, look back on those Cold War policies and reflect the same kind of sort of disdain and disgust with them that Peter sort of did. You know, we didn't promote democracy. We were hypocrites, et cetera, and we shouldn't have done that. But now we can do it. Now the reasons are good. I don't know why. What's really changed? The reasons are the same. And my argument is, of course, there are trade-offs. And, you know, I'm not making a cartoonish point. I'm making a point that, we need to understand that while it's true that not all democracies agree with each other about everything, not all the NATO countries agree with each other about everything. The United States and Canada don't agree with each other about everything. That needn't be an obstacle to trying to work together. We have tried much more fantastic ideas like the United Nations. What's a more fantastic idea than the United Nations about getting everybody to work together? I dare say trying to get democracies to work together will be even a little easier than trying to get all the nations of the world to work together. And yet I don't know too many people, certainly at this table, who say we shouldn't try the United Nations. I do think that we need to recognize that to some degree the autocracies have commonalities. Do they have differences? Do they disagree about many things? Do they have conflicting interests? Of course they do. I'm only pointing out, as some others and as the report points out, something that has been neglected, which is the degree of common interest they have as autocracies, that not that it's everything that they are, but that it is significant. I'm asking not that ideology be the determining factor in our foreign policy, but that the return to being a factor in our foreign policy. Because I think that for a variety of reasons having to do with the expectations after the Cold War and the end of history, which means the end of ideological conflict, we've now segued into there's nothing we can do about it, and after all, we have conflicting interests, that we have pretty much attempted to drain and, you know, this need to not be Bush, which is, which is the biggest amusement in the world. I'm sorry, David, forgive me. Even before 2006, the Bush administration wasn't seriously promoting democracy in too many places. It wasn't after 2006 that he decided to embrace Vladimir Putin, for instance. It was from the very beginning after 2001. He saw an ally in the war on terror. He wasn't engaging with China before that. The notion that we have to not promote democracy now because George Bush did such a bad job of not promoting democracy really strikes me as the ultimate irony. I probably had something else to say, but I'll stop right there.
Thank you very much. I would observe in concluding that this was a pretty lively discussion. Could you imagine this group, say, 10 o'clock at night with a bottle of wine? We're going to go to a short coffee break, but please join me in thanking Peter and Jim and Bob.